You're listening to West Virginia Week, a regular podcast from West Virginia Public Broadcasting that looks back at the major stories of the week. I'm your host this week, Bill Lynch. On this West Virginia Week, despite a government shutdown and the closure of national parks across the country, parks in West Virginia are staying open, for now. Also, a new book looks at the last public hanging in America, and they're out there. Paranormal investigators talk about paranormal Kentucky. Let's jump right in with a few short news stories. West Virginia's two national parks will be open this weekend, says Governor Patrick Morrissey, even if the federal government remains shut down. Maria Young reports.
For communities around the state's two national parks, it is hard to overestimate the importance of October tourism. There's the rafting, the leaf peeping, and especially Bridge Day.
There's nothing better than being underneath the bridge when the parachutes are opening and full colors are coming down with the fall colors. The combination is spectacular. We get travelers from around the country that come just for that day to raft with us and to stay with us.
That's Tom Wagner with Adventures on the Gorge. Tens of thousands of visitors are expected to flock to Fayette County for Bridge Day, the state's single largest one-day festival. But a two-week, $98,000 state deal to keep the two national parks open during the government shutdown ends on Friday, one day before the festival. On Tuesday, Morrissey announced the deal would be extended.
I want to be clear today that it's my intent that if the federal government fails to reopen by then, I fully intend to extend that agreement, and Bridge Day will go on as planned. Right now, we're working on the paperwork with the national parks to make sure that we can extend that agreement until the end of the month if it's needed.
At a cost of roughly $7,000 per day, Morrissey said the tourism dollars that come in this month make the extension a no-brainer. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Maria Young in Charleston.
One of West Virginia's oil and gas companies is entering a new partnership with the state to plug abandoned wells. Curtis Tate has more.
Governor Patrick Morrissey and the CEO of Diversified Energy announced the partnership in Bridgeport on Thursday. The company will contribute $70 million over the next 20 years to plug 1,500 wells. There are thousands of abandoned wells across West Virginia and too few public resources to address them. Morrissey said the partnership with Diversified could be a model for other states.
This is a blueprint, not only for West Virginia, but for the nation to follow as well.
The governor said the partnership would create 50 to 100 jobs, paying $75,000 a year. Uncapped wells pollute soil and groundwater and release methane into the atmosphere. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Curtis Tate in Charleston.
An annual report on obesity in America shows a slight improvement nationwide, but not in West Virginia. Maria Young reports.
The newest report by Trust for America's Health, State of Obesity 2025, shows 41.4% of the adults here are obese. 24.1% of the state's children are also obese, and that's the second highest rate in the nation. TIFA President Dr. Nadine Gracia says some seemingly unrelated challenges that West Virginia faces are driving up the state's obesity rates.
Households that have lower income and higher rates of poverty, housing instability, lack of access to health care, those are some of the types of systemic barriers that we can also see to healthy eating.
19 states had obesity rates of 35% or more last year, down from 23 the previous year. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Maria Young in Charleston.
Earlier this year, the West Virginia legislature banned artificial food dyes. Last week, an industry group filed suit to stop it. Eric Douglas has more.
West Virginia was the first state in the nation to implement legislation known as House Bill 2354 that banned several artificial food dyes from school lunches. That began on August 1st. A statewide ban on those same dyes and preservatives is set to take effect on January 1st, 2028. But the International Association of Color Manufacturers filed a lawsuit in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of West Virginia seeking to stop it. Senator Jason Barrett, a Republican from Berkeley County, was one of the supporters of the law.
My job is to do the best job I can for the people of the 16th District and all of West Virginia. And you know, if there are large corporations from out of state that don't like it, that's the least of my concerns.
It was not immediately clear when the complaint will be heard. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, this is Eric Douglas in Charleston.
Hundreds of U.S. hardwood companies and organizations have sent a letter to the Trump administration urging relief from tariffs. Chris Schultz has more.
The signatories of the letter include 30 West Virginia hardwood businesses and community organizations like the West Virginia Forestry Association and West Virginia University. Jeff Zangari is the general manager of Meadow River Hardwood Lumber Company in Raynell, Greenbrier County. He says foreign markets represent more than 70% of the industry's business, and he's concerned if tariffs don't let up, his business and the industry as a whole could go away.
If we go under, then that's 45 jobs gone in western Greenbrier County, West Virginia. So there's a huge impact in small rural towns like ours.
It is estimated the West Virginia forestry industry generates more than $3 billion annually and directly employs more than 30,000 people. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Chris Schultz in Morgantown.
You're listening to West Virginia Week, and now some of our top feature stories from the past week. Nearly 90 years ago, Rainey Bethea was tried and hanged as thousands watched along the banks of the Ohio River in Owensboro. Now his death, the last public hanging in the U.S., is the center of a new book that examines lynch culture in America. For the Appalachian Mid-South Newsroom, Derek O'Pearl has this story.
Everybody went, everybody had a wonderful time, and it was over just like that.
In a 2013 Davis County Public Library interview, the late Bill Shelton painted a shocking picture of the scene from Rainey Bethea's hanging. He remembers the festive atmosphere, the sea of people gathered around the scaffolding as Bethea walked calmly to his death.
They came from everywhere, and there was hawkers. They sold sandwiches, and they sold Coca-Colas, and you'd have thought it was a big picnic or something.
In her new book, American Bloodlines, Owensboro native Sonia Lee examines the 1936 case through court records, contemporary reporting, and her own family history. Lee was inspired to look into the case after learning her grandparents attended the hanging as newlyweds, and in her research, she learned she was related to the prosecuting attorney. She says it's made her think harder about racial violence and that it's not hard to draw a line from Bethea's execution to the police killings of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd.
There's just so many things layered up where things could have been different for Rainey Bethea. But at the same time, we can start to see the connections how racial violence is still evident in our communities.
On a summer morning in 1936, a 70-year-old white woman named Elza Edwards was found dead in her Owensboro home. A local doctor determined she'd been strangled and raped, and 2 days later, authorities shifted the investigation to Bethea, a man in his 20s who Edwards had hired to work in her home. Lee says the evidence against Bethea was flimsy, and that his multiple confessions may have been coerced.
One of the things that we can do through this case is to look and see how it might have been possible that justice would have been done. And that just takes a little bit of curiosity.
Four attorneys were appointed to represent Bethea during the rushed legal proceedings, including the son of the presiding judge. The Commonwealth's attorney chose not to prosecute Bethea for murder, which would have carried a sentence of death by electric chair. Instead, they sought a public execution under an archaic Kentucky law.
They brought an old law out of hiding so that they could then try for rape alone and hang.
After just 4.5 minutes of deliberation by an all-white jury, Bethea was found guilty. During the trial, his defense counsel called no witnesses and delivered no closing argument. A little more than 2 months passed between Edwards' death and Bethea's hanging, and in the run-up, a media circus descended on the town. Most of it focused not on Bethea or the details of the case, but instead on Florence Thompson, who had succeeded her husband as sheriff after his death just months earlier. The skirted sheriff, as she was known, was expected by many to be the executioner, though she didn't end up going through with it herself. Still, the spectacle drew around 20,000 people, enough to nearly fill modern-day Rupp Arena in Lexington. Today, there is no historical marker on the riverfront where Bethea was executed. That's something Rondalyn Randolph, local NAACP president and leader of the Owensboro Community Remembrance Project, has wanted to do for more than a decade.
It shows a respect to Rainey's humanity. It shows that our community is not that community anymore, and we're able to move forward by doing, you know, the right thing.
Lee is hopeful that her book and continued local efforts can ensure that this piece of local history doesn't fade from memory. For the Appalachian Mid-South Newsroom, I'm Derek Operley.
This story was produced as part of the Appalachian Mid-South Newsroom, a collaboration between NPR and several public radio stations in West Virginia, Tennessee, and Kentucky. Visit the special series page under the News tab on our website to find a link to this story and more. In August, the Democratic Caucus of the West Virginia House of Delegates announced a statewide listening tour. As the tour nears its midway point, reporter Chris Schultz checks in with the lawmakers about what they're hearing.
West Virginia House Democrats are heading out on a kitchen table tour to hear about the most important issues facing West Virginians. Delegate Mike Pushkin is a Democrat from Kanawha County and the chair of the state Democratic Party. He says they decided to call it the kitchen table tour because they expected people would want to discuss issues that they talk about in their homes.
Issues that affect their day-to-day lives, whether it's access to health care, affordability of health care, public education. What we're not hearing so much about is what the Republicans seem to be obsessed with these days, and that's divisive culture war issues.
So far, the tour has taken a rotating cast of the state's 11 Democrat legislators to four stops, including Huntington, Martinsburg, and Charleston. In Morgantown, attendants asked the lawmakers about a broad range of issues, from fixing local roads to how state Democrats can do a better job communicating with their constituency. But being a college town, particular attention was given to the younger attendants in the crowd and their concerns, like increasing costs of living and the lack of job opportunities.
If the state's going to have any future at all, everything that we do as legislators should be run through the prism of, will this attract young people to the state? Will this make young people want to stay in the state? Because unfortunately, right now, our greatest export in West Virginia are our young people.
Pushkin says the tour was conceived to give voters across the state, regardless of political affiliation, a chance to speak directly with their lawmakers. He says an added benefit is that it is useful preparation for the upcoming 2026 legislative session in January.
It helps us do our job. We can be better legislators. We can be better representatives of the people if we stay out there and listen to what the people need us to do.
One attendant in Morgantown asked why the legislature didn't do more to help the state improve its national standings.
West Virginia, along with Mississippi and Louisiana, have achieved third world status on the basis of poverty, education, and health. The legislature has responded with thunderous silence. Why?
Delegate Sean Hornbuckle, a Democrat from Cabell County, had a simple reply.
Simply put, it's been priorities. These have not been the priorities of this current legislature, and quite frankly, the Republican supermajority.
Delegate Anitra Hamilton is a Democrat from Monongalia County. With dwindling numbers both in the voter rolls and in the seats of power, she says Democrats have to work across the aisle to address the needs and desires they're hearing from West Virginians. But Hamilton emphasizes that success in the legislature does not happen in a vacuum.
I know a lot of times people look to elected officials, and the expectation is for us to be able to provide everything. But the reality is we depend a lot on organizations and agencies. We're all a big team.
Hamilton says one of the benefits of the tour has been to build a sense of community that she feels has been lost. A lot of people come to the meetings she's attended to say they want to be engaged, but just don't know how, and she encourages them to start locally.
And these are orgs that are open and want people to come and help serve. That not only makes our legislative process better, but it makes West Virginia better because they touch families and children every day. So if you want to get involved, please reach out in your community and look for ways within your community to get engaged.
The next stops on the Kitchen Table Tour are scheduled for Fairmont October 14th and Wheeling October 16th. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Chris Schultz in Morgantown.
Appalachia has a bunch of spooky stories. Marie Mitchell and Mason Smith, a pair of retired Eastern Kentucky University professors turned paranormal investigators, have collected some in a new book called Paranormal Kentucky, An Uncommon Wealth of Close Encounters with Aliens, Ghosts, and Cryptids. I spoke with the authors.
Let's talk about the book a little bit. How did you get to do a book about spooky stuff?
Well, for many years at EKU, I taught English 101 and 102. And English 102 is kind of the research class, so you have to have your students research a subject. Mm-hmm. And I got absolutely sick and tired of reading endless student papers about global warming. So I decided I would have them research paranormal phenomena.
And Mason's been interested in that for a long time. And I would probably be traveling with him to do the research. And we collaborate a lot on our writings. I just kind of sign myself on as co-editor. But the way we got connected with the University Press of Kentucky is Mason did an interview with the Humanities Council director, Bill Goodman, about Paranormal Kentucky, and someone from University Press heard him, called him up, and asked him to write a book based on his vast knowledge of paranormal activity. So it kind of paid off. We've humored him all these years, and now it's kind of finally paid off into a book.
Okay.
And it's fun to talk to people about, you know, what they believe they saw and put it in context, historical context or just regional context, and just try to figure out. It's like a mystery, a puzzle. Try to figure out if we could come up with any clearer explanations than what's already been presented.
Because it is an honest mystery. These are really serious people. They've devoted a good part of their lives to researching some of these phenomena, and they're not trying to hoax or make a bunch of money or rip somebody off. They really, you know, they would pass a lie detector test, and people have passed polygraph tests. And so we're thinking, well, what's going on with these people? What did they actually see out there?
But the problem is a lot of them were ridiculed by coming forward and saying, I think I saw a UFO, I think I saw Bigfoot, I think I saw a dog man, wolf man, goat man, you name it. It's harder then to come up with explanations because you're not collecting enough data, because once someone in the community comes forward with that information and description and is ridiculed, then others are reluctant to provide information of things that they might have seen because they don't want to be in that person's shoes of being kind of, you know, the butt of the joke in their community.
And the only way we're going to go forward with trying to understand what the phenomenon is to come up with a good, solid data set. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, they've been making fun of people for 70 or 80 years who said they saw UFOs and aliens, and they ridicule these people, so we don't have a data set. And suddenly Uncle Sam decides, well, we really ought to find out what these uncorrelated targets are, and they've spent all these millions of dollars on the ATIP program, the Advanced Aerospace Target Identification Program, to try to come up with a data set. Well, if they hadn't been ridiculing all these people, they might have had a better data set and they could have made some progress on what these things actually are.
Why do you think we're so interested?
Well, I think people are naturally curious, and this is something extraordinary that's happened in someone else's life. What we try to do is incorporate a lot of history so you learn something as you go along in reading the book.
And, you know, encountering things that are unexplained, it's a very human kind of experience. As far back in history as we can look, people have had contact with the numinous, whether it's in a religious context or a folkloric context.
And when I was talking to some of the people, I mean, it's like, well, what would I have done in that situation? So I think people can place themselves in the shoes of the person making the report. And we were just doing a talk at the Clark County Library in Winchester, Kentucky. And afterwards, a woman came up to us and she goes, you know, I saw a UFO, and it was years ago. She's an older woman, and she was standing in her parents' driveway, and she saw this bolt of light, and then after that, what she saw a UFO, a flying saucer, and we're going, well, what did you do? And she goes, you know, I was just so mesmerized about it, and we're going, but what happened? And she goes, you know, if they had lowered a ramp, I think I would have walked into it. I would have just gone up with them and traveled with them. And that just blew us away because that's not the response we expected. And that's probably not what we would have done. We would have just hightailed it out of there and hoped that they weren't going to follow us.
Yeah, I would have screamed like a kindergartner and run away. So, you know, I'm not a brave researcher. I'm a library researcher. You know, I like to read about the accounts, but I would not want to be encountering one myself personally in the flesh.
That was Marie Mitchell and Mason Smith speaking about their book, Paranormal Kentucky, from the University Press of Kentucky. To hear the rest of that story and more, listen to Inside Appalachia Sunday mornings at 7 and Sunday evenings at 6 on West Virginia Public Broadcasting. That's it for West Virginia Week. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you back here next week. As always, you can see these stories and more at wvpublic.org. I'm Bill Lynch.